I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University. We call it an American conversation with global attitude. This one is with a young fiction writer, Chris Adrian, who takes hold of the imagination with stories that are spirit-filled and very dark at the same time. Stories of children in sickness and pain, networks of suffering and loss and anguish that does not go away, but that may be full of constructive meanings, maybe even redemption. Chris Adrian is a medical doctor in San Francisco. He's a divinity student at Harvard. He's a writer of the Dave Eggers generation, a graduate of the Iowa Writers Workshop, a student of Marilynne Robinson, the novelist of Gilead. A Better Angel is the title of Chris Adrian's new collection of 10 stories written over about 10 years. Chris Adrian, these are not political stories, but they do make a 9/11 connection. Several of them are about sort of collective trauma, shared pool, something like the national debt of suffering. You said in another connection that you were trying to sort out the everyday misery of being an American lately, part of an immensely privileged community in crisis, a community that in many ways sees itself as in some ways chosen, even as we quietly worry about the ways in which we are unfavorably judged. What is the 9/11 connection here?
Well, I guess the reason that 9/11 keeps popping up in the stories is mostly because I found, like everybody, found myself immensely troubled by it. But then sort of year by year after that, I wasn't any less troubled. And I tend to write about whatever's troubling me most deeply at the moment, I guess. Mm-hmm. That used to mean writing about death mostly, and then most specifically my brother's death. He died when I was 22 and he was 25. And a lot of what's in the first two novels has to do with that. But as I got a little older and further removed from his death, in time at least, I think my capacity to be troubled by things that were not quite strictly so personal opened up, I guess, like sort of an individual capacity and an artistic capacity. And as I started to notice what a sorry state the world was in, and particularly America was in, it started to intrude into the fiction in areas that previously were more strictly personal or private, I guess.
I guess for all of us, I wonder, what is this burden of 9/11 or a lot of public trauma?
For in terms of the stories, the question I kept, or I meant to ask in them mostly was what my own, or what, not necessarily what my responsibility was for the state of things, but why I felt responsible for them. Like, even though it's probably a more pressing question, what an individual's responsibility is for the state of the world they live in. For me, the more engaging or interesting question as a fiction writer was, why do I feel like it's so personally my fault that George Bush is president, or none of the sort of redemptive promise that floated around in the first few days or weeks, maybe after 9/11, ever panned out? Why does it feel like that's all because I did not do something or did something wrong? And that's sort of the question that is entertained probably most at depth and probably most effectively in the title story.
We'll come to that story. I wanted you to speak about a story called The Changeling, about a boy, 10 or 12, who takes on the pain of almost 3,000 people who died in 9/11 and goes nuts, basically. It's a story about his father and his father's father trying to deal with his psychosis. At some point, he tells his psychiatrist, the little boy does, "We were born in the fire even as we died from it." And he says, "We are thousands." What it said to me was that this body of suffering doesn't go away. It's with us all. And in this case, it's kind of focused in an insane way on one person, and his father has to deal with it. How did that happen?
The troubling question that gave rise to the story was maybe a corollary of the question I was talking about earlier, not what's my responsibility or why do I feel responsible for the state of the world, but what do I owe the people who, of whose death there seems to have been made some expectation that things would change. And so the question that kind of rattled around in my head was, what would it be like if all those people came back with one collective voice to ask, what have you done for us? Either make sure nothing like this ever happens again, or make the world a place where this can't happen. And that sort of bigger question was meant to tie in with much smaller questions that centered around the boy and his dad and his father and the dad's feelings of being insufficient to his son's needs.
There's a very quotable moment in that story, Chris Adrian, in which the grandfather thinks the grandson is faking it, sort of, and the father in the middle has to work it out. And he says, I stand there a little while, stirring aggressively, wondering how he, that is his own father, the grandfather, can look at Carl and think he could contain such a reserve of pathology to pull out this unwitting impersonation, this utter ruination, this scourge. I don't know what's worse or harder to believe, that a little boy could be fucked up enough to harbor that sort of sadness and rage that the entity presents us with every day, or that thousands of souls could be fused by a firebomb into a restless collection of spirits that hungers for a justice it can only define in terms of punishment. Father's dilemma. And he resolves it in a way by inflicting a terrible wound on himself.
Mm-hmm. The way the father discovers, accidentally at first, that he can satisfy whatever it is in his boy that's turning him into this creature is to harm himself, and he sort of feeds the thing, whatever it is, with his own pain. And when he thinks ahead and wonders what if there's something final he could do to himself that would permanently satisfy either the pathology in his son that thinks he's not getting enough attention, or that his father doesn't love him, or the ghosts of all those people who died. And what he does in the end of the story is seems to achieve that.
Does it? We got to give it away. The father of this suffering boy cuts his own arm off in front of the child, as if to say, will that do it?
I think it's just his hand, but not that that's any particularly less egregious. The stories get a little gruesome and dark, but even for me at some point, I want it. I'm still a fan of happy or relatively happy endings, so it was meant to be a happy ending of a sort.
But there's the world of the changeling. It's a cosmos of irremediable pain that doesn't go away. But maybe here's the redemptive part. The father and the grandfather, in different ways, and the child are trying to meet pain with love in some strange way. The father is stupefied, the grandfather is impatient, the boy may be nuts, but they're all clinging to some, three generations clinging to some dream of a perfect world.
Mm-hmm. And responding to something that seems very enormous with something kind of smaller. Well, small but powerful, I guess anything is, you know, something as small as making breakfast and taking care of the kid. And
French toast.
And trying to keep him safe from the ministrations of some of the doctors, to what happens in the end where the father cuts his hand off, which is a much more extreme demonstration of love. But I think that's what the father means it as.
Chris Adrian, would you speak of another story called The Vision of Peter Damian? It's a sort of medieval tableau in 19th century Ohio. It's getting ready for a harvest feast, and then it's beset with a sort of plague. They're 9/11 visions again. Mm-hmm. Towers burning, bodies falling. And little Peter Damian, who first resists this disease, falls under it and tries to save his family from himself and as the cause of the problem. No religious ritual and no medical attention seems to deflect the plague, but out of the church choir of quarantined victims, so to speak, comes a sort of angelic voice reassuring people that we are going to live. How did this story come to you? And do I have it right as this sort of something like Camus' plague? There is hope in all this mysterious misery and death.
I think so. The story germinated, I guess, from a collision of two experiences. One was working in the hospital as 9/11 was unfolding. On that day, I was an intern in a pediatric program in San Francisco and went to work like usual. I was in the hospital by 7 or so, and so I was the person bringing the news to these families, and the sort of hospital environment and the atmosphere of illness stuck with me in some way as an association with what happened that day. The other experience that contributed to the story was having my first a teenage patient who died, who had a relapsed form of leukemia and was dying of a systemic fungal infection that couldn't be cured, and understood as over the course of time, just a couple of weeks that I took care of him, that he was going to die, and then did go on to die. As I wrote the story a few years after I knew him, and probably it was 2004 or 2005, I guess, by the time I wrote it, and the Iraq War was well on its way, and reports were starting to come back of teenagers this young man's age who were dying in Iraq. Mm. And so somehow the confluence of the boy dying in that hospital where I was working on September 11th of 2001, and the news of the American deaths in Iraq, and seeing the faces of those kids in the news, put the idea in my head of 9/11 being something that was costing the lives of young people in a way that was totally removed from the day itself. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure how we ended up in a 19th century village in Ohio, but the idea that sort of took off by itself, or that started to really engage me in a way that I couldn't get away from, was that what was driving our presence in Iraq and the deaths that were happening there was the fall of those two towers, and that this vision or idea was costing lives in a way that I could make very explicit in a story that that was totally removed from the actual impetus to write it. The danger with that sort of getting what for me is into reasonably fancy territory metaphorically is that you very quickly you're in danger of forgetting what you were writing about in the first place. And there's the, you know, probably the 97 or 99% chance that no one will ever put things together the way that you thought you meant them to. But even if I'm not a skilled enough wielder of metaphor to actually construct something that reads the way I want to, or changes someone's feelings, or changes the world, and at the end of the process, you generally end up with a reasonably good story that's entertaining to read and that people take something away from, even if it's not what you were planning on.
Come to what's the title story in this book? A Better Angel. It's built around a doctor who sounds a lot like you, except that he cheated his way through medical school and he's a serious junkie by the time of the story. He's negotiating, in effect, with his angel about the treatment of his father, his own father, who's dying of cancer. Do doctors talk to angels? What's that about?
I don't routinely, but you're right to notice that this fellow has a lot in common with me. I wrote that story actually probably about 8 months or a year or so after my dad's death, and he died in a way that's very similar to what's described in the story. And part of the impetus to write a character who was so at sea and despairing was a place to put some of the feelings I had about, as a physician and as a son, about not being able to make my dad better, basically, which no one could have done, but knowing that objectively was different from ever feeling it. The angel came in partly as, I guess was constructed partly as a voice of that character's inadequacy, But then, and I guess this goes back to the question that we were talking about earlier about personal responsibility for how the world at large turns out. And for this character, the idea that took shape was not just what if there was a character who couldn't make his father better and had this angel harping who was reminding him constantly that not just that he should make his father better, but that he could if he just behaved correctly or did the right thing for once or believed that he could conceivably,
Be fair to the angel, though. The angel is rather indulgent about the young doctor's drugs and sneaking morphine and Ativan and these things out of his father's supply. But the angel keeps saying, reach out, touch him, make a connection here before it's too late.
Keeps encouraging, saying that the character is capable of miracles and that he could make his father better. Part of that ties into what she's been saying all his life. When she first shows up, it's to say, you have a special destiny. I'm here to show you the way. You're going to change the world. And then he proceeds to, even with her to guide him, proceeds to sort of fall apart and become a junkie and do nothing. So the angel turned into sort of the voice that has sort of been bothering me or was an expression of a similar voice that doesn't manifest in visual or auditory hallucinations. I always feel like I had an extended discussion with my boss at the time when that story came out about how I wasn't a junkie pediatrician and I didn't see things. But in any case, it's a voice that's a little more subtle than that, but that asks sort of similar questions that, you know, if you believe what you're told in grade school, that everybody can grow up to be president, everybody can change the world, and that America in particular is a place that's amenable to change. And if you see that demonstrated in the past in any study of not just of the history that's presented to you in school, but the actual history that's out there in primary sources, you notice that we actually have made startling changes in the past. We made one not very long ago this month. And so all that, for me, added up to this sort of lingering feeling of responsibility and inadequacy for current events that found its way into expression through that particular dialogue between this character and the angel, who is who's flawed herself, and that's part of why she takes it easy on him. She's changed by the same drugs that he uses into a considerably softer and more accommodating creature.
Everything you're saying sort of rounds out the picture I had reading these stories of yourself as a writer, but a doctor who's hooked on human pain and longing and spirit hunger that medicine cannot hope to reach. I'm thinking of a character, Beatrice, in another one of the stories, The Sum of Our Parts. Beatrice has had a kidney transplant. She's just about to have a liver transplant. Medicine can do almost anything for her body, but it can't make her want to live, and she doesn't want to live.
Mm-hmm. The story is possible because she forgets that she doesn't want to live and is sort of entertained and intrigued by the pretty quotidian dramas that are going on in the pathology lab of the hospital where she's dying. And she almost decides that she's in love with one of the workers there and can almost conceive of living this sort of half-life with him. But then when her actual body dies, she remembers the reason that she jumped off a parking garage in the first place. She was an attempted suicide, and then takes off for better parts at the end of the story.
Funny, I'm looking at that very page in the book where the moment of her first suicide attempt is being remembered. It was not for no reason at all that she had thrown herself off the garage, not that she could recall the reason in her present state. She only knew that she did not wish to go back, and that it all had to do with a crushing sadness under which she had labored for most of her life, and which she had never blamed on anybody. At the very end, when she does die, she cried and ran off across the street and over the bridge. Halfway across, she took off, went up and away, in search of a place without loneliness and desire, without misery and rage, without disappointment, without crushing, impenetrable sadness. Who's to treat the sadness?
For her, nobody, I guess. She sort of defines what she wants by a series of negatives and then hopes that she'll find that wherever it is that she's going. It sort of raises the question of, or sort of presents that the particular malady, but doesn't say anything about how to make it better. Maybe that's a function of my not having had any experience even working in regular corporeal medicine at that point.
Well, it keeps coming through these stories that you are a doctor who sees somehow that bodies are not the problem.
Or not the only problem, I guess.
Yeah.
That's something that's, I guess, especially obvious in what I'm doing now, starting to learn how to be a pediatric oncologist. If we can cure these kids and let them grow up to live whatever kind of life they're going to live, then we should do it in a way that doesn't damage them irreparably, or restore their body at the cost of their saying their soul is a little too dramatic, probably, but the not body part, that we're capable of inflicting pretty heavy harm on that. I think it definitely behooves us to keep an eye on how things are going and offer advice about what interventions or strategies to help the kids get through things relatively with some relatively normal chance at contentment on the other side. If we know those, we should share them.
What do we know about those strategies, those treatments, even those invisible realities? I mean, really?
Not as much as we know about what set of chemotherapy agents to pick, but I think it definitely boils down to the very commonsensical notion that you should treat them like kids and help them keep as normal a life as possible while they're going through the treatment. Common sense notions in medicine, though, are, you know, it's rare that anyone will ever do anything because it's commonsensical. There has to be a randomized, double-blinded trial to demonstrate that common sense is is superior to horseshit.
Every time. Chris Adrian, I'm wondering, what does the outline of your own story tell us about this work? I mean, you've been in medical school and divinity school. You're into the natural and the supernatural. It seems so brave in certain ways to introduce not just angels, which are kind of a cliche, but the notion of a spirit reality that is in endless conversation with us, with the world, with individuals, but also with even countries. Where does that conviction come from?
I guess sort of demonstrated by a notion that I demonstrated to myself just by the way my own obsessions and the way that I've engaged in various troubling things over the years has proved to me, and that's that the dead people don't go away after they're dead. And I think that's true for the individuals who lose them, and for the communities and for the countries and for the world at large. And that was something that I explored in a relatively ham-handed, though satisfying personally, way in the first novel I ever got published, which was more or less about the Civil War, but more particularly about a young man who loses his brother in the Civil War and spends the next 10 years trying to build a machine that he thinks will bring his brother back to life, but also bring back all the other soldiers who died in the Civil War, with the idea that the whole world would be transformed if death were abolished and if the barrier between the spirit world that is imagined in that book is fully populated.
This is Gob's Grief, the name of the book. You're tough on yourself as a writer, as you are on yourself as a doctor. In these stories you write about yourself, or you write about the doctor subject, whose name is sometimes an anagram of your own, as an impaired physician, a junkie. What's all this about? This, I'm just kidding you, but about putting Chris Adrian down.
Well, part of that is just there's something kind of gratifying in a way to present your own worst fears about yourself on the page, something exercising in some way about them. Also, if you can describe this poor wretch who is considerably worse off than I think I ever have been or could be. But in writing about him, I come away feeling better about myself in a very shallow way, but also like I've engaged with some of my worst faults in a way that's useful, even though it's the way that I seem to do it is by sort of magnifying them into grotesque, sometimes, proportions.
The godfather of doctor writers, Chekhov, wrote at one point that he said, "Medicine is my lawful wife and literature my mistress. When I get tired of one, I spend the night with the other." Throw in pastoral, you know, ministering into your life. How do these things relate to each other?
Certainly seem to inform each other. I don't think I could do one without the other in some ways, or I would do either one much. I would be a worse writer and a worse physician, I think, if I weren't a writer and a physician both. Part of that is because the stuff I'm privileged to see in the hospital drives what I write about, even when it's not about a hospital, and it's less and less as I get older, oddly. Even though what I'm seeing and dealing with day to day is what makes me want to write, I end up not writing about medicine or about the hospital environment in the way I used to more. And then on the other hand, I feel like the way that I engage with writing makes it easier to imagine is probably the wrong word, because I don't want to say I imagine my patients' lives, or I have sort of imaginary presumptions or assumptions about what their lives are like, but I think that the habit of trying to imagine the world from somebody else's perspective, even if that other person is just some imaginary construct you're using in the course of your work as an artist or as a presumed artist, makes it easier to make room for how big people are in real life, if that makes any sense. And in the doctor-patient encounter, to keep in mind that there is a lot more to the world of the person sitting across from you than what is immediately evident or contained in that little room.
Does writing, does literature, so to speak, help spread the pain or share it?
I don't know. I don't know what literature does. I wish I had some faith that it does anything some days. But I think that it is helpful to share stories, even when they're transmogrified or warped away from the reality that inspired them. I don't know if that ultimately makes people more sympathetic. I don't know if making medical students read Chekhov would make them better listeners or more empathetic physicians, but that conceivably, at least I can say that it has worked for me, that writing has made room in me for that sort of an empathy that's derived from some kind of practice that can be taught.
Yeah. Chris Adrian, is it fair to ask where you come out in divinity school in the realm of doctrine or belief or affiliation?
Perfectly fair to ask. I wish I knew an answer. There's a little card on our registration forms, a little space on the registration cards at school where you're supposed to write in your religious affiliation, and mine is still blank.
Really?
Mm-hmm. I grew up Catholic and took that pretty seriously until I was 15 or 16 or so, and then fell away from it in part because I was, I guess, just asking some relatively normal teenage questions that couldn't find answers for in Catholicism. The other part was I was, you know, sort of understanding better and better at that time that I was totally gay then already, or was going to be totally gay pretty soon, and that it was going to be hard to find a home in Catholicism as a gay man. So for many years after that, even though I wasn't particularly Catholic, I was still thought of myself as pretty religious. That fell away in as I got a little older, and certainly as I got into grad school and got into medicine. And there, oddly enough, it seems to me no better proof that God doesn't exist than, you know, an 8-month-old baby with an inoperable brain tumor that's going to kill them in the next 6 months. Every one of those encounters that I have, and I haven't had that many, I want to text back to my friends at Div School, there is no God. But at the same time, I have a friend who describes himself as a lapsing atheist, and I feel that way sometimes, even though I haven't lapsed into anything of particular substance or of substance in such a way that I could put a name to it. I think if I were ordained, I would be ordained in the Unitarian Church. That's probably about as structured as I can get, which is not very structured at all.
One God at the most, as my father used to say about him. What is a medical and sort of theological student of human pain and human fantasy make of this widely shared feeling since the presidential election that something's turned in our lives?
It's kind of delightful, actually. I think it's an interesting, kind of a neat flip to the question we were talking about earlier about am I personally responsible for the mess that the country is in or the world is in? And if what was nice for me was that I found that I'm perfectly able to feel guilty about that all day long. But on the other hand, on last Tuesday, I was able to feel elated and this intense joy that was probably only as much personally earned as that same guilt is for the larger wrongs in the world.
Funny thing is, it gets better since Tuesday. I find people sort of coming out of their shells inch by inch, day by day. What are we going to do? What are the collective opportunities to make something better? Yeah. I mean, those bodies that are falling in your stories still from 9/11 may be rising again.
It would be nice to think so. This sort of is another weird way that the personal and the historical, or the personal and the political, end up kind of resonating with each other, is that, I feel like we were once a lot more than we are, but can be more again, and have sort of more ordinary everyday feelings of having once been, a pretty reasonably decent person, and having fallen away from that as I have gotten older and things have gotten more complicated.
Chris Adrian, in all of these stories, you bring the perspective of a scientist, of a dreamer, in a sense, or a soul believer for sure, and also of a writer. I keep wondering, what does imagination do for the doctor? What does it do for the patient? Should we turn out the television sets in all those hospital rooms? Is part of the question.
I think that, I would say yes to that. I think we're guilty as caretakers in pediatric hospitals of sometimes just parking kids in front of the television, and they sit there for days and days. Imagination is a prized attribute in any old elementary school, but also something that people look for in the medical academic world, but it's a particular kind of creativity. It's the kind that puts, A and Q together in a way that no one thought was not obvious to anybody, and so makes for a pretty startling change in the real world. And then there's another kind of daydreamy creativity or imagination that is not so prized, or so, I mean, it's not discouraged, but not fostered, I guess, in the same way that that scientific creativity is. I think that the processes are related to each other, and that there certainly would be no harm in trying to foster a more distracted, daydreamy creativity among the ostensibly rigorous scientific types. And there are some schools that are actually doing that. UCSF, where I work, is one of them. They have a kind of fledgling medical humanities program that tries to introduce that sort of thing to the senior medical students.
What does it teach?
Teaches, offers them the opportunity to take kind of more classes that have more of a sociological slant and then also like lets them write poetry and fiction and get credit for it.
You're reminding me of a moment early on in this book where Frida, the librarian, as the kid says, Frida tells me to watch my language, and she doesn't mean don't say fuck. She means don't say Whopper or Barbie's Dreamhouse or Happy Meal. Get out of the language of commerce and television.
That interaction is between a foul-mouthed, precocious kid and the bookstore owner that he's stealing from, but for whom he has a lot of affection, and one of the few adults that sort of says things that he thinks are sensible, one of which is that there is such a thing as a real world, a real word or a real meaning, and that's good for you to pick and choose your words carefully, even if half of them are curse words.
Where does the literary Chris Adrian come from? I mean, who are your models? Who are your teachers? What's the company you keep?
I guess I owe a lot to my teachers, and to two in particular, one of whom I encountered as an undergraduate and who basically made me into a writer in the kind of grossest sense of that phrase, or in the sense of the word made. That was Paget Powell at the University of Florida. He also steered me towards a writing program. And the other person who I was really lucky to have cross my path in person was Marilyn Robinson, who I was a teacher who's
Gilead.
Who I had in Iowa as a grad student, and who got me reading most of what turned into my reading list for the second novel. And I don't think I would have ended up in divinity school if I hadn't ever met her. So she had an impact on my life that went way beyond the writing in some ways.
What was on the reading list?
The one that she taught was Moby Dick. So we spent a whole semester talking about Moby Dick, and the reading list, the reading list was Moby Dick, that's all we had to read, but the books that she suggested were people like Dietrich Bonhoeffer and the Niebuhr brothers, and then more remotely, but most importantly, John Calvin, who I, as a, you know, who was the devil growing up Catholic, someone who I would not have, back when I was a kid and actually reading a lot of religion books, I would never have, I would have cut my own hand off before touching the institutes of the Christian religion. But I ended up reading a lot of Calvin in a kind of retarded grade school way compared to how Marilyn reads him. But what I took away from him became the sort of germ of what turned into the second novel.
What did you take away from him? What should we all know about the father of Calvinism, among other things?
I guess my retarded fourth grade take, but what that was sufficient for me, or sufficient to get me going with the novel, was that the sort of idea that there was really was something awful and terrible about God, but that simultaneously something incredibly tender and attentive, that could be reading him made that dichotomy seem perfectly sensible in some weird way. The other thing that I took away, which was the most surprising part, was this extraordinary appreciation for the natural world and for life, and oddly enough for this kind of everyday sensuality of experience, which really makes no sense when you think about what most people's conception of Calvin is, but made a lot of sense after, to me, hearing Marilyn Robinson talk about him, and then reading him through this kind of retarded lens that was reading him partly, you know, almost for pleasure in a way, taking away things that were inspiring for a story instead of taking away things that were going to end up in a term paper.
Chris Adrian, I've associated you in some way with the Dave Eggers school of younger writers in America today. Where do you put yourself in the longer historical chain? And let me drop the name Hawthorne somewhere in your past.
It would obviously be an incredible privilege to still be read in 50 years or 100 years, and to have somebody else ask that question about my work, and I sort of feel overwhelmingly silly whenever I try to entertain that question myself. But I think it's maybe a little bit easier to think of in terms of who the sort of dead people are that I found the most inspiring, and Hawthorne is among them. Poe, Melville, also George Eliot, a lot of poets, oddly, Hilda Doolittle, Elizabeth Bishop, and then of the more recently dead, unfortunately, Octavia Butler, not a poet, but a fiction writer, but a science fiction writer. And I read a lot of science fiction as a kid. It was mostly what I read at the expense of schoolwork and a social life.
How does a prized young writer feel about the literary estate at a time when people worry about reading? What does the prospect look like?
I don't know. It's an interesting question to ask now, or at least in the past few months, as the economy collapses more and more. I was just in New York and got to see my editor again, and we had a conversation about the prospects for any books in general over the next couple of years, about whether or not people would buy a $25 hardback when there are so many other interesting things to do with your money these days. And I certainly hear different things. Some people say that people will, that they'll read more when times are troubling because there's something more comforting, or more, there's something more sustained about the comfort that people who take comfort in books take when they read a book. I hope that's true. I think that bad times might be bad for book sales, but I think they're good for books, and generally the more interesting stuff gets written, even if it takes a while to get processed. I guess I'm more a fan of stuff that gets written in hard times or against hard times than stuff that's written in easy times, sort of against the easy times. So I think that it will probably just get more interesting rather than less, though I worry. One of another conversation I had just in the past couple of weeks was, what are we all going to write about now that George Bush isn't president, and we can't, like, secretly in our little fiction writer hearts have these magnanimous dreams that I'm going to write the story that gets him out of office, which is patently ridiculous, but certainly motivating.
If hard times make great literature, this could be a golden age. Are you superstitious, Crusadian, about talking about what you're working on now?
No. I'm working on a new novel that's a retelling or rehashing of A Midsummer Night's Dream, set in the present, or in the summer of this past summer, actually, and it takes place in Buena Vista Park in San Francisco, and is about five different individuals who get trapped in the park over the course of a night and tortured by the kinds of fairies with wings, and have sort of adventures and end up different people by the morning comes.
10 years from now, 2018, will Chris Adrian be doctoring, preaching, writing, two out of the three, or something else?
I think at least two out of the three. I guess the question about whether or not to get ordained is still somewhat open. I certainly hope I'll be practicing medicine still, and certainly hope I'll be writing. I can't imagine giving one or the other of those up anytime too soon.
Chris Adrian, it's a great pleasure to read a stylist who works at so many interesting levels, and it's a huge pleasure to meet you and talk on Open Source. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. This was great.
Sarah Archambault produced this conversation with Chris Adrian. Paul McCarthy edited it. Our intern, Hannah Olson, mined the meanings of Chris Adrian's stories with me. Post your own readings of contemporary fiction at our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Leiden. Thanks for joining the conversation.